morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, February the 17th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Nigeria, Africa's largest oil producer, is experiencing an acute fuel shortage, causing long lines of motorists at gas stations.
It's just unbearable. I've not gone to work for 2 days. Today is the third day. Does it make sense?
Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for overnight attacks on police and checkpoints that left at least 5 people dead. And Libya's High Council of State says that the parliament should have consulted it before removing outgoing Prime Minister Abdul Baber.
To say that Libya's political situation is confused would be an understatement.
That is Edward Yerenian, who will bring us more on this story ahead in the show. And Zimbabwe's government has ordered civil servants who are vaccinated against COVID-19 to immediately report for duty after more than a year of working from home. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, Nigeria, Africa's largest oil producer, is experiencing an acute fuel shortage, causing long lines of motorists at gasoline stations. Commuters are frustrated as some have to wait hours to fill up their gas tanks. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Lost amid hundreds of vehicles waiting to gain access to a petrol station in Abuja is even Frances' silver-colored Toyota Camry. She was in line overnight to fill up her car, she says, but has yet to get fuel.
I have not experienced anything of the sorts in terms of the fuel scarcity going on in Abuja currently. It keeps getting worse by the day, and the past few days have been horrifying.
Black market dealers line the road nearby, hawking the precious commodity, but Francis says the petrol is overpriced and a ripoff. Francis is among millions of commuters having a tough time getting around since fuel became scarce in Nigeria in late January. Nigeria's oil regulator, the National Petroleum Regulatory Commission, or NNPC, last week announced it had recalled some 170.2 million barrels of tainted petrol that was imported from Europe by 4 Nigerian oil companies. The NNPC has acknowledged the recall is the cause of the fuel shortage. Authorities said the petrol contained higher than normal levels of ethanol and had damaged many vehicles before it was recalled. The move has disrupted transportation in Abuja and other cities like Lagos and Port Harcourt. Abuja resident Oreva Okoro has been waiting in line for nearly 12 hours.
It's just unbearable. I've not gone to work for 2 days. Today is the third day. Does it make sense?
Nigeria's government has promised to fix the problem by importing clean fuel to replace the tainted petrol. On Tuesday, the NNPC said in a statement that it has over 1 billion barrels of petrol stored and ready for distribution. It said it has ordered its outlets across the country to commence 24-hour operations to ease the chaos. But energy expert Odion Omomfoman says it may take time before the fuel situation returns to normal.
Give or take, this might last a couple of days or at worst a couple of weeks.
Nigeria is Africa's largest oil producer and ranks 6th globally. But the country depends heavily on imported refined petroleum to meet its huge demand for gasoline. Nigeria's refineries have been shut down for more than a year, despite pledges by authorities to restore functionality. Critics say systemic corruption may keep the refineries shut longer. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for overnight attacks on police and checkpoints that left at least 5 people dead, including 3 soldiers and 16 wounded, in the capital area. Mohamed Sheikh Nu reports from Mogadishu.
In a televised news conference Wednesday, police spokesman Abdi Fitah Adan Hassan said the militant is used two explosive-laden vehicles to carry out the attack. He said explosionists and attacks carried out by the militants have killed at least five people, most notably two young girls and three soldiers. May Allah have mercy on them, he said, noting 16 others were also wounded. According to the Ministry of Internal Security, the assailants targeted government installations on the outskirts of Mogadishu, including the Kahda District Police Station. Sources say other areas that came under attack include Dar es Salaam and Eilasha settlements, both located outside the capital and a military outpost in the area. Residents in Kahda confirmed that the attacks began with loud explosions, which were followed by an intense exchange of gunfire. One resident told me he was extremely terrified by the explosions and the armed confrontation between government troops and the attackers. Militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the bombings and subsequent gunfight, saying the first blast was a suicide bombing that targeted a military base in the Kahda district before their foot soldiers launched a follow-up attack. According to Radio Andalus, a broadcaster that supports the militants, Al-Shabaab seized military equipment and vehicles after briefly overrunning the military base. The government has denied the claim, saying its forces repulsed the attackers. The Kahda District Police Station suffered the heaviest damages and most buildings were destroyed. The latest terror attack comes as parliamentary elections take place in many parts of Somalia, including Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab has threatened to disrupt the much-delayed elections, which political leaders are trying to complete by February 25th deadline. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
As Libya's parliament, which meets in the eastern city of Tobruk, prepares to approve a new national unity government next week, the country's High Council of State says that the parliament should have consulted it before removing outgoing Prime Minister Abdulhamid Dbeibah. Dbeibah is refusing to step down, and it's not clear how the situation will evolve. Edward Iranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
To say that Libya's political situation is confused would be an understatement. Both outgoing Prime Minister Abdulhamid Dbeibah and former Interior Minister Fathi Bashagha, the man named by Parliament to replace him, enjoy significant support among militia forces which control large chunks of western Libya. Both men are also from the western port city of Misrata, where divided loyalties make it even more unclear which man will prevail. Khalid al-Mishri, who heads the country's Tripoli-based High Council of State, is contesting the legitimacy of the new government. However, Parliament, based in the eastern city of Tobruk, insists that outgoing Prime Minister Dbeibah's mandate ran out on December 24, and that the popularly elected body, whose mandate also ran out, has the authority to name a successor. Fathi Melami, an advisor to Libyan Parliament Speaker Aguila Saleh, insists that the new government under Bashagha will govern no matter what anyone says, because Parliament has the authority to appoint him. He says the new government becomes official as soon as Parliament gives it a vote of confidence. Even if Dbeibah doesn't vacate his current offices, he says, there are other offices for Bashagha to use elsewhere. Parliament has made its decision, he adds, and the new government will take over once approved. Mohamed Hamouda, spokesman for outgoing Prime Minister Dbeibah and his government, however, insists that the move to appoint a new government was not made by Parliament in consultation with the High Council of State and is therefore not legal. He says that it is the responsibility of the High Council of State to appoint a new Prime Minister, and Parliament must approve his new government. Moves made by Parliament, he argues, were made unilaterally without consulting the Council of State. Libya security analyst Aya Berwaila tells VOA that opposition to the new government appears to be limited, with the exception of two Islamist militias led by Sadiq Gariani and Salah Badi. At the moment, the situation in most of Libya remains calm, and none of the militia forces on the ground appears to have reacted very strongly to the appointment of a new prime minister. That, however, could change once Parliament gives a vote of confidence to Fathi Bashagha's new government and he is given the actual task of governing. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Rival Anglophone separatist groups in Cameroon have clashed this month, causing an undetermined number of casualties. The fighting was triggered by power struggles within the separatist movement. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
Separatist leaders say rivalries among various armed groups are greatly affecting the movement's fight to carve out an independent English-speaking state from largely French-speaking Cameroon. Capo Daniel is deputy defense chief of the Ambazonian Defense Forces, ADF, one of the two biggest separatist groups. The other separatist group is known as the Ambazonia Restoration Forces. Ambazonia is the name of the state that separatists are attempting to create. Daniel says the groups clashed after separatist political leaders voted to impeach Samuel Sako-Ikome, the president of what the separatists call their interim government, or IG.
We have seen forces distancing themselves from command and control as a result of the impeachment of Sako-Ikome and the further splintering of the IG group. And we have seen Phil Masha, who is supposed to be the overall commander of the Ambazonia Restoration Forces, desperate trying to command loyalty from forces who have denied aligning themselves with him.
Lekeake Oliver, known as the Field Marshal, leads the Ambazonia Restoration Forces. On Monday, separatists on social media platforms said Oliver's group was clashing with the ADF in six towns across western Cameroon. The message noted casualties but gave no details. Cameroon's military says the fighting has been bloody in Kumbu, an English-speaking northwestern town. The military says at least 15 fighters have either been killed or wounded. In Kumbu, a self-proclaimed separatist who goes by the name Mad Dog says he is leading attacks against separatists who support Lekeaka Oliver. He accuses Oliver of corrupt practices.
As I defy this fight, so I never even received one bullet for you.
Mad Dog says he has not received guns, ammunition or congratulatory messages from Lekeaka since becoming the leader of the separatist fighters in Kumbu nearly 5 years ago. He says henceforth, Lekeaka's orders will not be respected in Kumbu. Mad Dog says he strongly believes that the self-proclaimed field marshal is a Cameroonian government agent pretending to be fighting to liberate English speakers in the majority French-speaking country. On February 2, the legislative arm of the self-declared Ambazonia interim government, known as the Restoration Council, passed a vote to impeach Sako-Ikome. The Restoration Council accuses Ikome of corruption, embezzlement of funds, and illegal deals with the government of Cameroon. Ikome has denied the charges. Former separatist spokesperson Eric Tato says the infighting may discourage separatist fighters.
My brothers of Ambazonia must come together. This is the time, because if we continue, the division is going to dampen the spirit of our people. I urge my brothers and sisters to come together. Let's put our hands on deck and fight one enemy, which is the Cameroonian government.
Cameroon's separatist conflict erupted in 2017 after teachers and lawyers in the north and southwest regions, where English is the predominant language, protested alleged discrimination by the country's French-speaking majority. The UN says the war has killed several thousand people and forced more than 500,000 to flee their homes. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Zimbabwe's government has ordered civil servants who are vaccinated against COVID-19 to immediately report for duty after more than a year of working from home, citing a decline in new cases of the virus in the country. Authorities also announced that any government workers without proof of vaccination will be barred from workplaces and face punishment, including a freeze of their salaries. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
In a statement this week, President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government said it wants its employees to resume meeting in person. Late Tuesday, Monica Mchangwa, the country's information minister, said the number of people being hospitalized for COVID-19 is on a steady decline.
This indicates that the national response measures instituted by government continue to pay off. That in view of the continued decline in new cases and deaths, coupled with a declining testing positivity rate, that is indicating that the community transmission is going down. All ports of entry be reopened, but ensuring that all the recommended COVID-19 preventive measures are adhered to.
However, the compulsory vaccination rule is not being welcomed by all civil servants. Obed Masaraure, the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, says the workers will take the matter to court if the government insists.
The contract that was signed by civil servants has no provision for mandatory vaccination. So if the Public Service Commission wants to bar civil servants who are not vaccinated, then breach of contract, and it's unacceptable. Civil servants have their own rights. They have the right to dignity. They have the right to make choices. No one can be forced to allow foreign substance to be inserted into their bodies.
Dr. Nomeni Matara, the head of the Zimbabwe Association for Doctors for Human Rights, says his organization has noted that several other countries are moving towards compulsory vaccination.
It's something that we are strongly against. We think that mandating vaccines is something that that fuels the vaccine hesitancy. There is a lot of conspiracy theories that goes around when people are saying we are being forced to be vaccinated. We really need to get the buy-in of people, spread the gospel of the vaccines, how they work, and then encourage people to get vaccinated and not force them to get vaccinated.
But Sifiso Ndlovu from the Zimbabwe Teachers Association supports the government's position.
Definitely, all workers should find it in themselves to take up the vaccination, not because they want to protect themselves, but they also want to protect their colleagues at work. The scientific evidence says it that if you are fully vaccinated, it comes with a mild attack. Why not take up that? Well, there's nothing wrong or sinister about it.
About 3.3 million people in Zimbabwe have received two shots of the COVID-19 vaccines, while about 86,000 have received a third jab. A number of Zimbabweans have refused to get vaccinated, saying they do not trust the mainly donated Chinese-made Sinopharm and Sinovac vaccines. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Rights groups Amnesty International says Tigrayan fighters have committed war crimes and possible crimes against humanity as they were withdrawing from Ethiopia's Amhara region. Gelmo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa.
Amnesty International's report released Wednesday says fighters affiliated with the Tigray People's Liberation Front TPLF killed escorts of Ethiopian civilians in northern Amhara region, looted property and gang-raped women and girls as young as 14 years. Amnesty said the Tigrayan forces committed the atrocities around Chenna and Kobo last August and September after taking control of the areas. The rights group says interviews with survivors indicate the Tigrayan forces were acting in revenge against Amhara militia that were fighting alongside Ethiopian federal troops to push them back. Sari Jackson is Amnesty's deputy regional director for East Africa, the Horn of Africa, and the Great Lakes. In a press release on the report, She said evidence was mounting of a pattern of Tigrayan forces committing war crimes and possible crimes against humanity in areas that were under their control. Jackson called on the TPLF leadership to put an immediate end to the atrocities and remove from its forces anyone suspected of war crimes. The TPLF did not immediately respond to the allegations, but previously denied Tigrayan forces target civilians. The Amnesty report appears to support a December Human Rights Watch report said Tigrayan forces executed scores of civilians in Hamara in late August and early September. Amnesty and the Human Rights Watch released a joint December report that accused Amhara security forces of killing ethnic Tigrayans in Western Tigray region. Throughout Ethiopia's 14-month war, rights groups have accused both sides of gross rights abuse and war crimes, including raping and killing civilians. Amnesty called on international community to investigate crimes committed by both sides and try to bring those responsible to justice. Gal Mudait for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The East African community may miss out on the 2024 deadline to fully implement the monetary union. A new audit report shows the delay is a result of lengthy process of decision-making in the community. Moses Havyarimana reports from Arusha.
The protocol for the establishment of the East African Monetary Union was signed by the East African Community Heads of State in November 2013 and entered into force in 2014, with the aim to promote and maintain monetary and financial stability in the region as member states will be using a single currency. George Odong is a member of the East African Legislative Assembly.
We are supposed to be moving towards the monetary union by 2024. That's the ambition, and we should be having a single currency. But that is not the priority as it is right now for council, and it's embarrassing that we are in this situation. It's already 2022, and we are left with 2 years, and we are not moving. There is no positive traction in the direction of achieving our pillar of single currency and monetary union.
The Audit Commission revealed that four Monetary Union Institution bills are still pending. Two bills are yet to be assented by the heads of state, and two other bills being reviewed by the Sectoral Council on Legal and Judicial Affairs. Ezekiel Nibigira is the Burundi Minister for the East African Community Affairs.
Remember that in this report, they have highlighted that even the recommendations of the council are not implemented. So this means that we are going to join our hands together so that the recommendations that are made may be implemented.
The report indicated that 35 bills are yet to be assented to. The current East African Legislative Assembly, since being sworn in 2017, have passed 18 bills, but three had been assented to by the heads of state. Martin Ngoga is the speaker of the regional assembly.
The commitment of the ministers. We are only advocating for the change of the ways we do business. Let us change the way we have been doing business. Let us do it differently for the betterment of our community. The commitment is there, but let us activate it into the actionable way of more better delivery than we have done before.
James Kakoza, a lawmaker from Uganda, says that the delay in the implementation of the Monetary Union Protocol is due to the delay of the Council of Ministers.
We are waiting for the legislation. It's not yet in place. There is no way you start a monetary union when there is no legal framework to do that. But otherwise, we, as an EAC Parliament, we are ready. We are waiting for that. Because the technocrats from the National Council of Ministers, which will depend on to bring those bills and we pass them. And I don't think we can start to implement that without a legal framework.
To attain and maintain macroeconomic convergence, the protocol of the Monetary Union provides a set of primary and secondary performance convergence criteria to be met by 2021 to enable the introduction of a single currency in the region. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.